Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to the Science of Success. Introducing your host, Matt Bodner.
Welcome to the Science of Success, the number one evidence-based growth podcast on the internet, with more than a million downloads and listeners in over 100 countries. In this episode, we explore luck. Does luck exist? Is there a science behind luck? What does the research reveal about lucky people and unlucky people? Is it possible to manufacture your own luck? We speak with research psychologist Dr. Richard Wiseman and learn the truth about luck and how you just might be able to create a little bit more in your own life. I'm going to give you three reasons why you should join our email list today by going to successpodcast.com and signing up right on the homepage. There's some amazing stuff that's only available to our email subscribers, so be sure to go there and sign up. First, you're going to get awesome free guides that we create based on listener demand, including our most popular guide, How to Organize and Remember Everything. You can get that completely for free, along with another surprise bonus guide by signing up and joining the email list today. Next, you're going to get a curated weekly email from us every single week called Mindset Monday. Short, simple, actionable, science-based advice that you can implement into your life. Listeners have been loving this email. Next, you're going to get listener exclusive content and a chance to shape the show, vote on guests, change our intro music, even submit your own questions to upcoming guests. So be sure to stay on the list. Only people on the email list have access to these opportunities. You can sign up by going to successpodcast.com, signing up right on the homepage, or if you're on the go, if you're out and about, driving around, whatever else, you can text the word SMARTER, that's S-M-A-R-T-E-R, to the number 44222. In our previous episode, we discussed the habits of high achievers, the motivation myth, dug deep into the habits, routines, and strategies you can use to achieve more in less time, talked about the balance between hustle and hard work versus recovery, and much more with our guest, Jeff Hayden. If you want to get the habits and strategies the top performers use to achieve results in the real world, listen to that interview. Now, without further ado, here's Dr. Richard Wiseman. I did want to give you a heads up. He is in England, so we had a little bit of a choppy connection. Nothing too bad, but I just wanted to let you know before the interview starts. Here we go. Today, we have another awesome guest on the show, Dr. Richard Wiseman. Richard has been described by the Scientific American as the most interesting and innovative experimental psychologist in the world today. His books have sold over 3 million copies. He began his career working as a magician and now holds Britain's only professorship in the public understanding of psychology. His work has been featured across the globe, and he's delivered keynotes to the Royal Society, the Swiss Economic Forum, Google, and more. Richard, welcome to the Science of Success.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, we're very excited to have you on today. So I'd love to start out. I definitely want to dig into a number of things you've written about and spoken about. To start out, though, your background and the journey of how you kind of became fascinated with all these different subjects is fascinating. So I'd love to begin with that and hear a little bit about, you know, how you began and sort of where that journey took you.
I guess I began with my passion in life, which was magic and performing magic. So when I was around about 8 years old, I saw my first magic trick, really got into it, and went to the public library and started reading a lot about magic. And so I was a professional performer in my early teens, and then started to look more at the psychology of magic, because if you're going to be a good magician, you need to understand how your audience thinks and feels. And it's a pretty tough order, because you're standing in front of a group of strangers and you need to do psychology experiments, a la magic tricks, night after night, and fool every single person in the room. You can't have a good night where you just fool 80% of people. So you do have to understand how people's minds work, where their attention is, how they're perceiving what's in front of them, how they're remembering the performance afterwards, particularly when they discuss it with their friends. And so I just became interested in that very practical applied aspect of psychology, and essentially became so interested in it that I studied as an experimental psychologist first at University College London, which perhaps not surprisingly is in London. And at the end of that, was looking for an interesting PhD. And by chance, I saw a poster up on the wall. This was the days before email, so we used to communicate with posters. And there was a poster up on the wall saying that there was a professor in the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, and he was interested in the psychology of deception and was looking for a candidate explore that topic with him. So I applied to the University of Edinburgh, was accepted on that course, and spent 4 years looking at deception. And then at the end of that, came back down to the south of the UK, to the University of Hertfordshire, and started to work on social psychology and on the psychology of self-development. And that's where I've been ever since. So I've only really had one proper job, which has been at the university, and that's been for 20-something years now. But that's basically the kind of line through in terms of my career.
So the psychology of deception sounds fascinating. Tell me a little bit, what were kind of some of the fundamental conclusions or ideas that you uncovered when you were working on that?
Well, part of it, again, was looking at the psychology of magic. So, you know, magicians need to convince you of a certain narrative, and that narrative has something impossible in it, you know, that somebody levitates or appears or disappears or whatever it is. But behind that narrative, you have the real narrative, that the method, as magicians like to call it, the trapdoors or the mirrors. And we were looking at ways in which magicians encourage you to think one set of things and not ask certain questions. So if you take a very kind of simple trick where you ask people to think of a number between 1 and 10, and then the magician might predict that people are going to say number 7, that's to do with the fact that if that trick fools you, it's to do with the fact that you don't realize that 7 is the most frequently chosen number, and so on. So they hide that little bit away from you. So that was one part of it. The other part was looking at the psychology of lying, and particularly whether people, when they lie, give off more information, give off more tells, if you like, using their body language or using the words they say. And so we carried out quite a well-known experiment on the British media, where we had a very well-known political commentator go on to a television program. And I interviewed him twice, once about his favorite film. And he told me he loved Gone with the Wind. And then asked him a second time about his favorite film. And he told me he loved Some Like It Hot. And of course, one of them was a complete lie. Yes, he hated one of those two films. So we had the public vote onto which they thought was the lie. And in line with all of the experimental work into lying, they were about 50-50, no better than chance. Most people think they're good lie detectors, but they're really not. When we took just the soundtrack of those two interviews and put them on the radio, or just published the transcripts in a national newspaper, people's lie-detecting abilities went up into the 60-70%. And the reason for that is that when we lie, it's very easy to control our body language, you know, whether we gesture or smile and where we look. It's much harder to control the words we say and how we say them. And so if you shift people's attention onto those attributes, they become much better lie detectors. And that was all part of that deception work as well.
That's fascinating. So an average person will be essentially no better than a 50-50 chance of detecting a liar if they're looking at a video of someone. But if you take them to the transcript, you said it goes up to 60 to 70%?
Absolutely. It's one of the simplest of fixes. And so if you're thinking someone's going to lie to you, actually just getting them on the phone is much better than interviewing them or speaking to them face to face. And in fact, actually, I return to that. And I know we'll probably talk about 59 seconds later on, but I return to that topic in 59 seconds, which is my book about these sorts of things. And the other aspect of lie detection is that people don't want to commit the lie to paper, to something that you can look back and go, hold on a second, you told me that at that point. They rather like the idea of it being a spoken lie, because then they can say, oh, that you've misremembered what I said. And so in 59 seconds, I was talking about some of the research, which is that if you want to find out whether someone's lying to you, that the magic words to use are, can you email that to me? And if they are lying, that email will never arrive. Or when it does arrive, it's somewhat different than what they just told you face to face. So I became just interested in these simple wins, these things which are evidence-based that can have a very big impact.
That's fascinating. I love that simple sort of practical strategy of just asking someone to email you and then sort of gauging whether that's different from what they communicated to you. I'd love to transition because there's so many things I want to talk about in this interview. Your work on luck is one of the most fascinating things that I think you've done. I'd love to kind of start out with, you know, many people think of luck, they think that it's kind of randomness or chance or sort of arbitrary. You know, from your perspective and from the work and the research that you've done, what does it mean to be lucky and does luck exist?
Well, that work dates back a long way. It dates back to the late 1990s, actually. And at that time, and this was before really the kind of evidence-based self-help movement was around. It was really a little bit before even what's called positive psychology was around. And I was talking to people about key moments in their lives, how they ended up in certain relationships and certain careers. And they would talk about these lucky and unlucky moments. They would talk about themselves being a lucky or unlucky person. And at that point in time, really people, psychologists, had dismissed the concept of luck. They'd said, look, it's just random. It's like winning or losing the lottery, that there's no science to be had here, or these people are kidding themselves, then they're not really lucky. And so I embarked on this research project, which was gathering together about 1,000 people who considered themselves exceptionally lucky and unlucky, and then presenting them with various tasks and seeing how they responded. And what we saw, even very early on in that research, within probably the first 6 months, it was a four-year project, but within the first 6 months, we saw very big differences emerging between the lucky and the unlucky people. And so we came to the conclusion towards the end of that project that for the most part, and it's not true of every aspect of your life, but for the most part, people are creating their own luck by the way they were thinking and the way they were behaving. Now, they didn't realize that. It didn't look like that to them. That would be like a magic trick. To them, it looked a magical thing that was just happening and that they were either destined to do well in life or fated to do badly. But we could see that unconsciously they were using certain tricks to accomplish that. And that then formed the basis of my very first book, which was the Luck Factor, which again was the first kind of evidence-based take on self-help, where we were saying to people, look, don't just listen to a self-help guru, ask for the evidence. We've done the experiments. We can tell you what we found. And here are some exercises that hopefully will make you luckier in life.
Well, I want to dig into how to create or manufacture your own luck. But before we do, I'm really curious if you could share maybe an example or two or a story from some of the research you did around luck, because I know there's some really kind of interesting and compelling examples.
Well, we had a lot of them. I mean, in terms of and there's enormous consistency. So I think the lucky people are, you know, always in the right place at the right time, lots of opportunities, they always fall on their feet and so on. In terms of the unluckiest people, we had one woman who had 5 car accidents in one 50-mile journey, which she put down to her jinxed green car. And then one day she came to the university and we watched her trying to park the car, and we realized there were a few other factors in there. And she was also unlucky in love, so she signed up with a dating agency, and the first date came off his motorbike and broke his leg. The replacement date walked into a glass door and broke his nose. And eventually, when she found someone to marry, the church they were going to get married in was burnt down one day before the wedding. And that was how her whole life had gone. That was very typical of the unlucky people. You know, everything they touch was an absolute disaster. And then on the flip side, you have these lucky people who wanted to start with a new kind of business venture and went to a party and, you know, met somebody there by chance. And that person was exactly the person they needed in order to catapult themselves forward. And they became millionaires and so on. So very big differences between the two groups.
And how can somebody, for example, the woman who is consistently unlucky, how could she sort of transition or become someone who is lucky? What were some of the differences between her and a lucky person?
Well, if we start with the differences, one was a very interesting, almost perceptual difference, actually, in terms of how they were seeing the world. And this was the form, the basis for an experiment we did that's then become quite well known in terms of having people look at a newspaper. So we asked people to come into the lab to flick through a newspaper and just count the number of photographs in the newspaper. It's a fairly dull thing to do. What we didn't tell them is there were two large opportunities placed in the newspaper. One was a half-page advert with massive type that said, "There are, stop counting, there are 42 photographs in this newspaper." And the other was another half-page advert that said, "Say you've seen this, tell the experimenter you've seen this, and win whatever it was, £100 or something." And what was fascinating was the lucky people tended to spot those opportunities. And so they would stop and go, "My goodness, that's great. You know, I don't need to count all the photographs, or can I have my prize now?" The unlucky people literally turned the page and didn't see them. And that's to do with this notion of an attentional spotlight, that when we look at the world, we're not seeing everything that's in front of us. We're seeing a small part of it where we place our active attention. And when you become worried and anxious and concerned, as the unlucky people were, that becomes very small. You become very focused. And in doing so, you don't see something if you don't expect to see it. The lucky people were far more relaxed and far more cheerful, had a larger attentional spotlight, and so more likely to see opportunities they don't expect and also act on them. So that was the type of study we were doing in order to try and tease really what was happening, why one group would say, "My goodness, I get all these opportunities," and another group would say, "You know, I never get a break."
I love the newspaper experiment. I think it's one of my favorite examples, and I'm so glad you shared it. And it just demonstrates really clearly that, you know, it's not necessarily sort of fate and random chance that's causing people to be lucky or unlucky. Obviously, there's a factor of that. But in many ways, you know, you can kind of create your own luck.
Absolutely. I mean, that was the premise of the research. And then what we did was to go on and test that and say, well, hold on a second. If we take a group of people who are not particularly lucky or unlucky, and we get them to think and behave like a lucky person, does that increase their luck? And that data forms the basis of the Luck Factor book. And we found the very simple exercises. So probably our simplest one, but one of the most popular, and which is now a well-known exercise, but at the time it wasn't, which is just getting people to keep a luck diary. And at the end of each day, writing down the most positive thing or positive thought that's they've had during that day, or one negative event that used to happen is no longer happening, or some sense of gratitude they have for their friends or family or health or job or whatever. That starts to reorient people quite quickly. So one of the issues with the focusing is that if you're an unlucky person or think you are, you literally do not see the good things in your life until you start to carry out that exercise. So it's a very, very simple intervention, and found it was the simplest of interventions that had the most powerful effect. But you could see dramatically over the course of a month or two, people becoming more positive, becoming luckier because of those interventions.
I'd love to dig into a few of the other kind of tactics and strategies that you talked about that people can use to create their own luck.
Well, there are lots of them. We looked at intuition. Lucky people tended to be a little bit more intuitive than unlucky people. They tended to be risk takers without being reckless. They also tended, when bad things happened, to be very resilient. So whereas the unlucky people would always generate what are called positive counterfactuals, that is, when a bad event happened, they always imagined how it could have been much, much better. So, you know, if they, fell down the stairs, broke their leg, they said, well, I could have fallen down the stairs and not broken my leg, and therefore this is a terrible, terrible outcome. What lucky people do naturally is imagine that it could have been far worse. And so they'll go, well, I could have fallen down the stairs and broken both of my legs, for example. And so that automatic generating of negative counterfactuals really helps people with resilience, as does finding the silver lining, that no matter how bad the event, there will be something good that has come from it. And again, lucky people very naturally do that. Unlucky people, it's very, very hard for them, until that exercise is pointed out to them, to find the positive in what seems like a negative event. So all these things are very simple, but I think we're the first people to really try and put numbers to them, to kind of go, okay, let's test this. Let's find out what works and what doesn't work.
And I just want to confirm again for people listening that your research came to the fundamental conclusion that people who are and think of themselves as unlucky can learn these basic behaviors and literally sort of manufacture or create their own luck and become a luckier person just by implementing a few of these behaviors.
That's right. I mean, it doesn't feel like that at the time. It feels like, as I say, something magical or supernatural is happening, but it is deeply psychological. It's not true of everything. I mean, there are some events in your life that really are chance and nothing to do with you. But for the most part, you're creating your own good and bad luck by the way you're thinking and feeling. More importantly, change how you think and feel, and you can increase the luck you experience. And that was the very radical notion which underlied the Luck Factor book. And so when that came out, it sold right across the world and became this kind of big bestseller, which was a lovely thing to see, that we could take our research and give it not only a national but an international platform for people.
And what would you say to someone who's listening and sort of thinks to themselves, yeah, that sounds great, but that's not going to work for me, or, you know, that's, you know, it's not going to happen when I do it, or I can't train my mind to see the positive in things?
I guess we heard that a lot from the unlucky people. And what we found was it was the simplest of interventions that had the big effects. The problem with some of these more interventions is that people get confused, or they don't have the willpower to keep going, or they're not quite certain what they should do. So everything is very simple. We know it works with the vast majority of people. I have to say, not. There's around about 20% of people that rather enjoy being unlucky. And what I mean by that is their self-identity is bound up with that. They're the person that goes to parties and knocks over glasses and, oh my goodness, that's clumsy me. Everything I do, absolutely terrible. And at some level, they're enjoying that. And at some level, are deeply afraid to move away from that identity. And those folks are very hard to reach, actually. But for the vast majority of people, actually, these things do work. But you do need to do it. You know, if you give up before you start, clearly it's not going to have much of an impact. You need to do these things. So to the person that says, well, they don't work or won't work, I would say come back after a month of doing them and then tell me that. If you tell it to me right now, I'm going to be a bit skeptical because, you know, you're giving up before you've started.
So you mentioned the luck diary. We talked a little bit about sort of finding silver linings. What are some of the other really simple strategies that people can implement?
Well, part of it was about flexibility, that even when the unlucky people saw an opportunity, they were very scared to move forward because they were in a rut and they rather liked routine, even though it wasn't a very successful routine. So getting people to be more flexible, getting people to try things they haven't tried before, going to work or college with a different route, listening to whatever it is, radio, so that you don't normally listen to, trying different types of food, altering your conversational style if you're normally spending a bit more time, vice versa, if you're an introvert, going 2 hours without saying the word I, all these things give you a sense of flexibility. And that means that when an opportunity comes along, you're far more likely to make the most of that opportunity rather than go, no, I'm not that sort of person. I'm not the sort of person who's flexible and changes.
So even these simple sort of daily interventions, things like taking a different route to work, changing the conversational sort of strategies or styles that you're using, maybe going for a walk randomly or to a different place that you don't typically do. All of these create sort of the behavior or the sort of competency of flexibility, which then enables you to kind of capture luck, quote unquote, when it sort of falls into your lap.
That's pretty much it. It puts you into the mindset of, in that instance, of somebody who's flexible, who changes. I mean, the one thing we know about life is it's not predictable. The strategies that worked last week may not work so well next week. And so you need to be able to change and alter the sort of person you are. And lucky people were like that. They were very open to an uncertain future. They thought they'd be able to cope, but they were very open to an uncertain future, where the unlucky people really liked the idea of a plan. And so that even if that plan didn't work out, they would still keep on repeating it because at least it had some certainty to it. Also, lucky people tended to be team players. They tended to be trying to negotiate win-wins all of the time and to build up a network of contacts around them. They were very, very well connected. The unlucky people tended to be socially isolated. And so if they had an idea, they hadn't really got anyone to bounce it off of. They hadn't got that experience of talking to somebody and them going, oh, you should meet my friend. They're really interested in that. And that plays an absolute key role in success. So that was about the social side of it rather than the cognitive side.
That's really interesting. And so these, you know, that's kind of another one of these learned behaviors, is that if you become more social, you can also create luck essentially through sort of the network effect of meeting and engaging with more people.
Oh, absolutely. I can remember one lucky person who came into the lab and they were trying to sell their car. And we're doing the experiment. On the way out, they spoke to one of the secretaries in the department. And they were chatting and then said to the secretary, you're not interested in buying a new car, are you? Because I've got a car I'm trying to... And the secretary said, oh, I am actually. How weird you mention that. Yeah, I am. And so the two of them got chatting and he ended up selling his car to her. Now, that's a very, very good example of him creating his own good luck. He will look back on that and go, my goodness, what are the chances that I just happened to bump into somebody? The fact is, he was bumping into people all of the time. He was buying a lot of times a day in that sense, and occasionally he'd hit the jackpot. The unlucky people simply weren't buying the tickets. They weren't spending any time with other people or exploring those relationships in an open way. And so they weren't getting those opportunities.
Yeah, it's the old kind of analogy that, you know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, right? And so lucky people, it sounds like, and according to the research, are essentially sort of constantly dabbling and exploring all these potential opportunities and sort of things that may emerge. And then when it does, they're like, oh, look at that. That opportunity kind of emerged.
That's right. And also, particularly with social networks, if you hit a node, if you hit somebody who's very well connected, then you're massively increasing your chances. So you're not just talking to that person at that party. You're essentially talking to all of the people they know. And so if you're talking to somebody who's well connected, it might be that opportunity is not for them, but they'll say, oh, let me introduce you to so-and-so. And so with networking, the way it works in terms of how we're connected to others, it's very easy to get access to a very large number of people. And that's what the lucky people were so skilled at doing.
Well, I think digging down the rabbit hole of how to build relationships and social networking is probably beyond the full scope of our conversation. But for listeners who are curious, we do have another interview with Keith Ferrazzi that goes super deep into a lot of strategies you can use to implement many of those different things. I'm curious, I'd love to kind of transition a little bit. I mean, the luck factor and all the work you did there is really fascinating. But I want to talk about some of the other work you've done, because I also think it's really aligned with what the show focuses on and what we often talk about on here. In 59 Seconds, which is one of your other books, you talk at length about sort of debunking some of the myths and confusion points in self-help. I'm curious, what kind of led you to want to write that book?
59, I mean, all of the books have slightly odd origins. 59 was because I went out for lunch, I think it was, with a friend of mine who's the CEO in quite a big organization. And she started to talk about happiness. And she said, oh, you know a bit about happiness. How does it work in terms of psychology? I started to answer. And she said, you know, I'm quite a big, sort of quite busy person. Can you really tell me and sort of cut it down a bit? And I said, well, how long have you got? And she said, around about a minute. And I thought that's kind of an intuition, that are there ideas in psychology that can be conveyed? And so originally the book was called 60 Seconds, and we round, and it was about evidence-based learning less than a minute. And at one meeting, I said precisely that. I said less than a minute. And someone said, well, that's not 60 seconds, it's 59 seconds. And that's a much better title for all sorts of reasons. And so part of that book is debunking the myths of self-help, things which we all like to believe, which simply aren't true and therefore are hurting us. And then the other part is, and here's what you can actually do to be more successful in these various domains, such as happiness and relationships and parenting and so on. So that was the origins of that book. And it then became a very successful YouTube channel and has been all around the world again. So, you know, it's probably the book I'm best known for. And actually the quickest one to write, I think that was probably written in about 2 months. So it was a lot of stuff that I'd been storing up in my head.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hiring the right person takes time. Time that you often don't have. But you shouldn't let a time crunch get in the way of finding the right candidates for your business. That's why LinkedIn is the best place to post your job. In fact, I was on LinkedIn Jobs this morning looking for candidates to fill a key role in one of my businesses. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates with hard and soft skills you're looking for so that you can hire the right person quickly. You can look for things like collaboration, creativity, and adaptability, looking beyond just work skills and resumes to connect you with the candidates who are a perfect match for your business. That's how LinkedIn makes sure that your job post gets in front of the people you actually want to hire, because they have a much better ability to get a deep insight into exactly who is the right candidate for you and your business. Find the right person meant for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want, and the first $50 is on them. Just visit linkedin.com/success. Again, that's linkedin.com/success to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply.
What were some of the big myths that you uncovered that kind of permeate self-help?
I think the biggest one was this notion of visualization, that there are so many self-help books that tell people to visualize endpoint. That is, to visualize yourself in 5 years in the perfect relationship, perfect career, whatever it is. And when you look at the psychology to an experiment, there isn't a single experiment that doesn't say that that is a terrible, terrible idea. It makes you feel good, which is why people like doing it. The problem is, in terms of success, in terms of bringing that future into reality, it sets your expectations very high and encourages you not to do anything else. All you need to do is dream. And so when that future doesn't emerge, then you become very discouraged. You think, well, I gave it my best shot, and quite fatalistic, and so very unlikely to move on to other strategies. So there's probably about 10, 15 papers now showing that across pretty much every domain, that aspect, that application of visualization is a terrible idea. There's an equally large literature that says that visualization is a powerful tool, but you visualize process, not endpoint. If you want to do well in an exam, you visualize yourself doing the sorts of things good students do, asking questions in class, revising, you know, going that little bit further than the other students or whatever. You don't visualize yourself sitting down and having a wonderful exam or opening an envelope and taking out an A grade certificate. So I think that was one of the key things. I mean, that notion that visualization of endpoint is now all over the place. But I think we're the first to sort of bring it into kind of public consciousness.
That's a great distinction, because I think it gets lost on a lot of people when they talk about visualization. The methodology itself can be effective, but it needs to be applied to a process as opposed to an endpoint.
That's correct. That's correct. And then there's a large literature suggesting exactly that. But even within it wasn't known. And so you know, all these athletes are being encouraged to visualize exactly the wrong thing. So it's a complete waste of time. So it was nice to sort of dig up some of these. The other one was brainstorming, this notion of all getting together in the room and coming up with ideas, again, reduces creativity by around about 20%. So, you know, as we speak, there'll be organizations around the world where everyone's sitting around in a room and trying to solve a problem in a creative way. Brainstorming, terrible applied in that particular way. What is far more effective is everyone brainstorms on their own, and they arrive at that meeting ideas, and you go around the table and everyone discusses their three ideas. Then you see big increases in both the number of ideas, obviously, and the originality. So it's a very simple tweak, but it's a very important one. We've been getting brainstorming wrong for many, many years.
That makes a lot of sense. So what was the sort of science or the reasoning behind why brainstorming in a group is so ineffective?
There's two bits of science behind it. One is social loafing, which is that put anyone in a group and some people would just simply not try very hard, because then there's two lots of thinking on it. One, they're thinking, well, if I come up with a key idea, the whole group gets the kind of glory for that, which I don't like the sound of. The other is I can just lean back and let everyone else do the work. And both of those ideas means that people don't tend to engage very much. The other is that within any group, you'll get some people that dominate. And, you know, who knew the most dominating people are not the most creative? And they end up telling you all their ideas, and the quieter people don't get a word in. And so simply by having this very simple intervention, simple change of everyone arriving with three ideas gets rid of all of those problems very, very effectively.
And what were some of the other kind of myths that permeate self-help that you uncovered in 59 seconds?
Quite a few of them in there. I mean, I think when I was writing it, the notion of the Harvard motivational study, which is the study where the Harvard researchers, I mean, yeah, well, it's credited to various universities, but normally Harvard. Harvard researchers go in, ask kids what they want to be when they grow up, and only 3% know, and that 3% for 20-something years accounts for 90% of the income of the cohort. Used all over the place to encourage people to get their kids to focus very young. And when you look at the evidence for it, there simply isn't any evidence. That's a complete work of fiction. That experiment has never been conducted. And people need to know that there is no hard evidence that getting children to focus very young will have any positive impact on their long-term success or career. So, you know, again, you know, parents didn't know that. And I regularly talk to organizations, and you get people in the audience saying, I just had no idea. That's entirely fictitious. So there's quite a lot of kind of myth busting in that book.
You know, I'm curious, because one of the things that we focus on a lot on the Science of Success is what we call evidence-based growth, which is basically thinking about the world from a perspective of evidence first and trying to understand what does the science say, what does the evidence say, and what does that mean for us as individuals trying to achieve our goals and sort of create a better world. And why do you think that it's so hard within self-help to to bring that evidence to the forefront. And there's often, it seems like there's so much noise that it's really challenging to sort of distinguish what the signal is.
I think it's hard for two reasons. One is that we're equipped with common sense, the problem being it's often wrong. But, you know, intuitively, it feels like if you get kids to focus young, that would be a good thing. Intuitively, it feels that all sitting around a room and kicking around some ideas is a good thing. Our intuitions are often wrong. So that's one reason why it's tricky. The other is that the psychological literature is really spread out. I mean, it is immense now. And that you need a fair bit of expertise to even find out where the relevant papers are, and even more expertise to be able to read them and actually know what they're trying to say in terms of the data. So I think it is very, very tough for people to actually find the evidence. And that was really the thinking behind 59 Seconds, to be honest, actually, was saying to people, look, I will do all that hard work for you. And I think I've probably read close to a couple of thousand papers, academic papers for that book. I will do all that hard work, and then I will present it in a way that I think is fair and with some take-home messages. But I think it is very, very difficult, particularly now with the web, when there are just so many websites out there telling you so many different things. And unless you have access to those primary sources, you're not really going to know who or what to believe.
And so what can a well-intentioned individual who's not a scientist do if they're looking for these kind of bastions of evidence-based strategies in today's world?
Well, obviously, read my books is the main thing. That's why I always advise anyone to do. But I think always ask the question, where's the evidence? Where is this coming from? And also, how much are you investing in it? Because if it's something which is going to take you a couple of hours every day or something like that, you're going to want to know that there is some kind of evidential underpinning, that it's in a peer-reviewed journal or whatever it is. So I just think asking for evidence is absolutely key, and not believing something just because it sounds plausible or it's easy. If it's, you know, the sort of thing which you enjoy doing, well, it may not be having a wonderful effect on your life. And also, if you're not becoming more successful with it, if it's not making you happier or improving relationships or so, just stop and do something else. So it's not rocket science, but I appreciate that it can be quite tricky for people, particularly on the evidential front.
Yeah, I think that's a struggle that we think about a lot is, you know, how can, you know, obviously we on the show, we take a lot of time, we read through a lot of the research, we try to find people who have done their homework and actually speak from a position of, you know, sort of scientific authority. But it's definitely a struggle, you know, and I think a lot about, there's so much just noise out there. How can we see through the mist and figure out, all right, what's actually true, what's actually effective? And you know, it's something that's kind of a mission of ours and that we spend a lot of time thinking about.
It's important work, and it's even more important when you move over to the health domain, where people are doing all sorts of weird procedures that aren't helping at all. And so some of the sort of cutting edge health research is showing that some of the things we thought were extremely helpful in even in terms of some sorts of surgery and pills and so on are simply having no effect. So if it's a problem there, it's definitely going to be a problem when you move over to psychology.
Well, I'm curious, there's one other strategy that you talked about in 59 Seconds that I thought was really interesting, which is the idea of writing your own eulogy. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a lovely idea. I mean, it's not when you come to do it. It's quite a terrifying idea. Practically, it's lovely, which is this notion that we don't realize perhaps life is, and it's very easy to get distracted and to just simply have a good time and not think about the bigger picture. And it's only when you get slightly later on in life that you start to realize there are things you wish you'd done and that some things are a little bit more meaningful than others and so on. And writing your own eulogy is a nice way of cutting to the chase. And so you say to somebody, you know, what do you want someone to stand up at your own funeral and say about you? It's a very effective way of setting goals. And so if you ask people to do that, then look at the discrepancy between what they've written for that perfect eulogy and their life as it currently is. You can see people suddenly start to shift and go, well, I'd like someone to stand up at my funeral and say, what a kind person I've been. I've helped all my friends and family. And then you say, so currently, are you helping your friends and family? And they say, no, I'm not. And so it's fairly obvious where the shift is. So it's a lovely exercise. There's a lot of psychology to to back that up into a field called terror management. And it's very interesting. So yeah, it's something I recommend actually to all of my students.
What is terror management?
Terror management theory is this notion that there are certain things that scare us and how we respond to that. And of course, the biggest thing that scares us is death. And so most people run away from death. But actually, when people to confront the fact that it's fine, one of the few things we know with 100% certainty, actually, it isn't quite so scary. It can be quite empowering. And that's a very old idea. I mean, the idea of memento moris, which was, you know, you see skeletons in paintings or something like that, those are there to remind the viewer that life is short and that you should live the best life possible right now because your life may end much sooner than you think. So it's a very old psychological intervention, but it's one.
I want to segue now and get into a little bit to talk about the as-if principle. I find that really, really fascinating. And it's something that, you know, I think is worthwhile to share with the listeners. Would you talk a little bit about kind of what that is and how you came to talk about that?
The as-if principle, again, dates back to the roots of psychology and particularly to William James, who's one of the founding fathers of psychology around the turn of the last century. And the obvious way of looking at the link between, let's go with behavior and emotion, is that your emotions create certain behaviors. And that feels like common sense. So when you feel happy, you smile. What James did was to question that and turn it on its head and say, well, is the opposite true? Is there a kind of back channel, which is that if you force your face into a smile, do you end up feeling happier? And he wasn't an experimentalist, he was a philosopher, and so posed that question in various domains before the experimentalists come along and start to go, well, let's ask that question. You know, when you behave in certain ways, does that affect the way you think and the way you feel? And they found that it did. You behave as if you're happy, you feel happier. You behave as if you're confident, you feel more confident. And that is the basis of the book, which in America is called the as-if principle. And I just explored that very simple idea in lots of different domains.
Is that essentially the idea of fake it till you make it?
A little bit. I think it's not same as that, in part because the word kind of fake it has a slightly different meaning to it. But it is that notion that if you, yes, behave in a certain way, that will affect how you think and behave, think and feel. Fake it until you make it is often about how it influences to perceive you. And it's not quite that. It's more about how your behavior affects yourself and then that affects others. So it's the fake it till you make it is, oh, I'm going to appear very confident and other people will see me as more confident. The as-if principle is I'm going to act more confident. That makes me feel more confident and therefore I am perceived as more confident.
Tell me a little bit about the science behind that. What does kind of the research say, or should you share some of the specific conclusions or examples from some of the studies?
Well, in terms of the actual pathways, we don't really know. To be honest, there is a very profound theory that sits behind it. And this is why it interested William James. The theory is that your entire common sense notion that you feel happy and therefore smile is simply wrong. That you have no idea how you feel until you observe yourself. So it gets to the roots of consciousness. So the idea is that sort of there's someone sitting in your head that's watching your behavior and then deciding how you feel. And so that, according to that theory, it's absolutely crucial that you behave in sort of certain ways because it really does influence how you literally see yourself. So it has there's a profound debate within the consciousness movement about why it may work. What we do know is across very many different domains, you see the same effect again and again and again. And so, in fact, actually one of the most controversial illustrations of it but still one which I think has still got merit, is the power posing, which is Amy Cubby's work, where you stand in certain ways and you feel more powerful and so on. Now, there's a lot of debate about that particular brand of work, but still the fundamental principle there, which is your actions dictate how you feel and think, I think is sound.
Tell me a little bit about specifically, how does the as-if principle apply in the context of things like phobias, anxiety, or depression?
Well, if we take the last of those, depression, it's a very effective way of getting people out of depression, which is that you get them to behave as if they're not depressed. I mean, if you get depressed people to be far more active, to do things like gardening, to be more involved in exercise and so on, it alleviates the depression reasonably rapidly. The same with phobias, where if you're scared of whatever it is, a spider, if as you slowly bring a spider towards someone, you get them to behave as if they are not afraid, i.e. they relax and calm down, it gets rid of the phobia very quickly. So it's a very simple idea, but it sits throughout the entire history of psychology in all these different domains, which actually hadn't ever been pulled together before. And so that book is talking or is reviewing areas which actually within the academic psychology would normally be seen as quite separate and populated by academics that don't normally talk to one another across those areas.
Do you have kind of a specific kind of concrete example of how somebody could apply the as-if principle to happiness, for example? So just thinking about, you know, if I want to be happier, what sort of things would I do if I were happier? If that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, happiness is the easiest one because you think, well, how do I behave when I'm happy? Maybe you sing and maybe you dance and maybe you smile and maybe you talk to other people and maybe you go out for the evening to a party. Well, do all those things. Do all those things and you will feel happier. The problem is motivating yourself to do that. But once you do these things, you'll feel happier. So all you say is, well, you know, how do I behave when I think and feel like that? Okay, I'll force myself to do that. And the effect is very, very fast. So you feel those effects within about 30, 40 seconds. They're some of the fastest moving effects in psychology. So, you know, it's simple stuff. But for some reason, it's not something that often comes up on people's kind of common sense radar until they start to think about it.
How do we generate the willpower, the motivation to actually take those actions? Especially, you know, I feel like it's hardest to do that when you're in a negative state.
It is hard, but it's not that hard. So I think, you know, singing, if you're on your own, singing a song, dancing around, whatever, they're not that difficult things to do. It's not like some huge happiness intervention where you need to think about your explanatory style and whether you've just applied it. But, you know, it is just having a good time. So I think that's very important. It's also in terms of explaining away your internal states. And so if you're, I don't know, nervous before a talk and you can feel the sort of butterflies in your stomach, you can relabel those. You can say, well, I'm not nervous. I'm acting as if I'm excited. And that relabeling then changes how you see yourself. And you go, well, I'm excited to give this talk. Let me get up there and start. Not, I'm nervous. I don't really want to go up there and start. So it can also apply to how you label and perceive internal states.
So labeling could also be kind of a powerful component of acting as if you were happy or confident or excited, et cetera.
That's right. If you see your own behavior in a different way and in a more positive way, then that again changes how you think and feel. So it's a curious one because the principle, the theory links together all these different ideas in psychology. And it's for me why the book was interesting to do because it goes right across, you know, motivation and persuasion. So if you know, you're trying to get someone to do something and you start paying them more and more money, their motivation drops. The reason being, well, what sort of task do you need to pay me to do? A task that I really don't like. So when you start making me behave as if I don't like this task by giving me more and more money to do it, you see my motivation drop. So it starts to explain these kind of counterintuitive findings that you see in psychology.
What would be one piece of homework that you would give our listeners to concretely implement some of the ideas and strategies that we've talked about today?
Oh, my goodness. I think actually picking up on what you're saying about the eulogy, I think is good. I would say probably the best thing that comes out of 59 in terms of success is the pre-mortem, the idea that before any, you convince yourself that project has been an utter disaster, and you try and figure out why it failed so badly. It's one of the most effective ways of finding out problems with a scheme before that scheme starts, because otherwise you get this huge rose-tinted view, you're convinced it's going to be great, and you don't take the necessary precautionary steps. So I think the pre-mortem is very helpful.
And where can listeners go if they want to find you, your books, and all of these resources online?
RichardWiseman.com is my website, and the links off of there will take you to my YouTube channel, which is In 59 Seconds, which has a lot of these tips and hints there in a minute. Then obviously there's the books. We've spoken about Luck Factor and 59 Seconds, As If Principle. There's a few other, we'll look at sleep and dreaming in a book called Night School. It is all out there, and it's lovely when people read that material and feedback. And so, you know, if people have supported that work over the years, my thanks and gratitude to them.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing all this wisdom, so many different strategies and concrete evidence-based things for people to implement in their lives. It's been an honor to have you on here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much for listening to The Science of Success. We created this show to help you, our listeners, master evidence-based growth. I love hearing from listeners. If you want to reach out, share your story, or just say hi, shoot me an email. My email is matt@successpodcast.com. That's matt@successpodcast.com. I'd love to hear from you, and I read and respond to every single listener email. I'm going to give you three reasons why you should sign up for our email list today by going to successpodcast.com, signing up right on the homepage. There's some incredible stuff that's only available to those on the email list, so be sure to sign up, including an exclusive curated weekly email from us called Mindset Monday, which is short, simple, filled with articles, stories, things that we found interesting and fascinating in the world of evidence-based growth in the last week. Next, you're getting an exclusive chance to shape the show, including voting on guests, submitting your own personal questions that we'll ask guests on air, and much more. Lastly, you're going to get a free guide we created based on listener demand, our most popular guide, which is called How to Organize and Remember Everything. You can get it completely for free, along with another surprise bonus guide, by signing up and joining the email list today. Again, you can do that at successpodcast.com, sign up right at the homepage, or if you're on the go, just text the word SMARTER, S-M-A-R-T-E-R, to the number 44222. Remember, the greatest compliment you can give us is a referral to a friend, either live or online. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us an awesome review and subscribe on iTunes, because that helps boost the algorithm, that helps us move up the iTunes rankings, and helps more people discover the science of success. Don't forget, if you want to get all the incredible information we talk about in the show, links, transcripts, everything we discuss, and much more, be sure to check out our show notes. You can get those at successpodcast.com. Just hit the show notes button right at the top. Thanks again, and we'll see you on the next episode of The Science of Success.